This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Phoebe Judge. When writer David Joy began his latest book, Where All Light Tends to Go, he started with a specific image, a little boy hunting with his father. The scene is a familiar one in the Appalachian Mountains where the novel is set, and it's just one of the many vignettes where Joy uses the mountain culture and landscape to shape his narrative. Author David Joy will speak tonight at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill, tomorrow at The Regulator in Durham, and Friday at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh. But first, he joins us on the program. Welcome, David.
Nice to be here.
So the idea for this novel, as I mentioned, came from the idea of this one scene. How did that come to you?
I was standing with a friend, a guy named Sam Jennings, that lives in Cashers, and he's got a hog lot, and we were standing there at his hog lot, and I just remember having this really vivid image of a young boy standing over a pig, having been told by his father to kill this pig. And I didn't know a whole lot about him, but I knew that he was recognizing how much power he had over life and death. And I lived with that image for a really long time before I ever heard his voice.
And this turns out to be the main character of your book, Jacob. Who is Jacob?
Jacob McNeely is a boy born and raised in Glenville, and his father has always sold drugs, and Jacob has been brought up in this environment, and he's been expected to kind of take part in this his whole life. And because of that, you know, he's because of the circumstances that he grew up in, he's never really had an opportunity to leave.
And the other big character in this book is Maggie. Who's Maggie?
I think Maggie also grew up there. But Maggie's different in the sense that she was never going to stay. I think very early on, you know, it keeps repeating that she always had her eyes on the distance. And the minute that she set her eyes on someplace else, it was very obvious she was going to get there. And so Maggie becomes sort of the embodiment of hope in the novel. And so there's this balance of hope versus fate. And I think Jacob is very much locked to fate. Maggie kind of is the epitome of hope in the story.
And Jacob is certainly in love with Maggie.
Yeah, and always has been.
Will you read for us and set it up a little bit?
Yeah. And this is the opening scene. And ultimately, Jacob is on a water tower looking down at all of the people he grew up with graduating high school. I hid the pickup behind a tangled row of pompous grass that had needed burning a good year or so before. The law never liked for folks to climb the water tower, but I hadn't ever cared much for the law. I was a McNeely, and in this part of Appalachia, that meant something. Outlawing was just as much a matter of blood as hair color and height. Besides, the water tower was the best place to see graduation caps thrown high when seniors wearing black robes and tearful smiles headed out of Walter Middleton School one last time. Rungs once painted white were chipped and rusted and slumped in the middle from years of being climbed by wide-eyed kids looking to paint their names on the town. Those things that seemed as if they'd last forever never did. I didn't even make it out of 10th grade, and maybe that's why I hadn't felt the need to scale that tower with britches weighed down by spray paint cans. There was no need to cement my name. A name like Jacob McNeely raised eyebrows and questions. In a town this small, all eyes were prying eyes. I couldn't show my face. Didn't want the problems and rumors that being down there would bring, but I had to see her leave.
In the writing process, you went through many drafts. In fact, you destroyed some initial versions of this book. Why?
Harry Cruse had this idea that the writer, you can reach a place in a novel where you know it's wrong and that the coward will move forward knowing it's wrong, and not be brave enough to start over, and that the writer sets it on fire. And I've always believed in that. And I wrote, I don't know, probably 30 pages first, and it was wrong. The next go round, I wrote somewhere around 40,000 words, about half a novel, and it was wrong. And I knew it was wrong. And so I just burned it and started over.
In a world of computers and such, do you actually burn it or do you press delete?
I do, because it was very symbolic of Larry Brown did the same thing. Harry Cruse and Larry Brown both burned them. And so I printed it out, and when I printed it, I deleted the file on the computer, and then I went and burn it.
You live in Western North Carolina and you set the book there. How vital is the setting of the mountains, of that place to you?
I think it's the landscape that I know, and I think that it's the voices I hear. But I think that what that landscape contributes to the narrative is kind of the worldview. And there's really two ways to look at living in the mountains. And for some people, it's like, you know, you're sitting in the palm of God's hand, kind of you're nestled there. And for other people, it can seem very confining. You look around and you're surrounded, you know, you're absolutely surrounded. And so you can feel trapped. And I think for Jacob, it's kind of the latter. I think he's always felt trapped there.
And Appalachia really does kind of shape the book. I mean, it's almost like a second character. It's always there, right?
Yeah. And I think that's true of all Appalachian literature. You know, Ron Rash's work wouldn't be what it is if he set that somewhere else. The characters and the stories are, you know, the grit-lit rough south of people like Larry Brown, William Gay, Harry Cruz. But the reality is that his story differ in a lot of ways because of where they're set. They're very specific to the mountain landscape.
You mentioned that this mountain life others find comforting and think it's the best place in the world. Others can find it isolating. What about you? What's your experience, and has it created this place for you to write?
I think I'm able to see it both ways. You know, in a lot of ways, I have anxiety when I hit flatland. Flatland to me seems endless, and so my mind starts to race, and I have an anxiety attack when I get on flatland.
How are you doing right now?
I'm in a studio, so I'm freaking
okay.
out. But at the same time, I can understand the feeling trapped there, and I think part of it is the circumstance, and part of it's there are very few opportunities in Appalachia.
A lot of the book focuses around, and the action of the book focuses around meth, which is obviously a big problem in the western part of the state. Did you worry in any way about perpetuating stereotypes by focusing on this meth issue, or, I mean, is it just the reality?
I think it's both. At the same time, I think a writer has to work fearlessly. The nice thing is that when it comes up, it's a subject of conversation. And the minute that you can start to have a conversation about it, you can address the problem. The reality is that, you know, methamphetamine and prescription drugs are a problem in Appalachia, but they don't define us. And it's no different than anywhere else in the country. If I'd set this novel in an inner city, it might have been crack cocaine or prescription drugs. The story is a story of poverty.
Will you read to us again?
Yeah, of course. There for a while I got caught up in dreaming, and dreaming's an awfully good thing when you don't have to wake up. But staring back at the light only to stumble further into darkness hurts worse than never dreaming at all. That phone call from Rogers brought me out of my dream and showed me what was real. I sat on that lonely couch in Daddy's house and sipped on a beer that had gone warm. I drank it not to celebrate, but to fog that wicked world into something a little easier to swallow. There was no escaping who I was or where I'd come from. I was born to a crankhead mother who'd just been cut loose from the loony bin. I was born to a father who'd slip a knife in my throat while I slept if the mood hit him right. Blood's thicker than water, and I was drowning in it. I was sinking down in that blood, and once I hit bottom, no one would find me. Some souls aren't worth saving, I thought. There are some souls that even the devil wants no part of.
That's David Joy reading from his new book, Where All Light Tends to Go. David reads tonight at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill, tomorrow at the Regulator Bookshop in Durham, and Friday at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh. What role does community play in this book and in this story?
It's a bit difficult. The role of community in Appalachian culture is huge, but in this novel, it doesn't play so heavily. Partly because of how quickly this book moves. You know, this takes place over about 3 weeks, and so if someone's not essential to the story, they're not really in it. It's a really small world that I'm painting, and the reason it has to be painted that way is because of how quickly the narrative is moving, the pacing.
But if it were longer, you would have more chance to kind of talk about the characters in a small community and the way in which they kind of impact your life.
Yeah.
I guess you can't really escape these characters if you live in such a small community. Everyone knows everyone's business.
Yeah, yeah. I think if I was going to try to find someone in this novel that's indicative of someone from Jackson County, it would be the minister at the funeral. And the minister is, keeping people after church and asking them to stay because he doesn't want the church to be empty during this funeral service. That's Appalachian culture, and that's the community that I live in. Is a man who would say, "I don't want the pews empty while we bury this woman," and so there are things that are taking place in the background that are very indicative of where I live.
For you, the book is violent in a way. I mean, it's not grotesque, and it's all seems very right. It's violence that needs to be told to talk about the story in this life. But what's it like to create those scenes of violence? Quiet scenes, it seems to me, in a lot of the instances in this book. Do you have to know violence to write about it the way that you do?
I think I grew up in a world that, I was surrounded by drugs and violence. Not so much in my own home, not at all where I lived, but a lot of the people I grew up around were surrounded by it very early. But part of it's the type of literature that I'm coming out of, Cormac McCarthy or something like that. And I can remember finishing the novel and telling my sister I was in a really bad place. And I said, it's going to take me a very long time to find my way out of the darkness I created. And that was true. And it did. It took a long time to find my way out of the world I'd created.
A world that involves talking about the different colors of blood, which is something I never thought of. But you seem to spend a lot of time in the book really trying to get those details right.
I think part of the reason that the details had to be right in this is because it's a first-person narrative and because Jacob has such a hard time with violence. Jacob's not a violent person. He's not cut out for this world at all. And so the fact that he's witnessing this firsthand, I want it to be exactly like that for the reader. I want them to see it exactly how he would and be shocked in the same fashion that he is as he's witnessing it. And I think that's why it was important to get those details right.
And so, like for the rest of us who don't see that type of violence as a reader, it's probably the way that we might see it as well. Walking into a horrible scene, we would see it as Jacob sees it.
That's the hope. Yeah, that's the hope.
Will you read to us again?
Of course. Of course. And this is... I say a lot of people ask me about the title, and so I thought it'd be a really good place to read from the paragraph where the title comes out. The preaching was just a murmur in the room now, white noise that played in the background while my thoughts spoke and held me in a trance. I reckon the closest I'd ever come to understanding an idea as big as God was the light that flickered in the eyes of the living, the light that Daddy never had. I'd seen that light in every living thing from squirrels to elders, and I'd seen that light burn out when it ended. I thought about that hog in Whiteside Cove, and I could see that hog's eyes clear as day, the way those lights had cut out like a switch had been turned when that pig huffed one last bloody breath. Then I thought of Mama, the way her eyes had glimmered that afternoon we spent talking, and the way those lights were long since gone when I found her there, eyes open, mouth gaping, brains blown sideways. There was a place where all light tends to go, and I reckon that was heaven. That lighted place that was what the Indian had his eyes fixed on in the picture Mama fancied, and I guess that's why she wanted to get there so badly. The place where all that light gathered back and shined was about as close to God as I could imagine.
That's David Joy reading from his new book, Where All Light Tends to Go. You set this book in a place that you grew up. And I wonder when you do that, and so you have all of this real knowledge of where this character is driving, the roads he's driving down, are there places that are your favorites that you want to be able to put in?
Oh, I grew up in Charlotte, but I moved to the mountains as soon as I could. And so I've been there a very long time. At this point, close to half of my life has been spent there.
I think that we can just say that you're, you know, it then. You're an authority.
But the things that really stick out in my mind are places, if you're from Jackson County, you're familiar, you're going to see things in this book that you'll recognize. And it's tiny details. It's things like the fact that Hamburg Cemetery is built on the side of a hill. And to dig a grave 6 feet deep, you have to dig 13 feet on the other side, like that type of hill. And the fact that the flowers blow down that hill and they pile by the highway. Those are the types of things that I'm trying to pay attention to. I love the tiny stuff.
And also, you speak about the way of life. You talk about like foods, like liver mush, right?
Yeah.
For people around here, we don't know about liver mush much, but in Western North Carolina, they eat this stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I grew up eating liver mush. I think that's a North Carolina thing.
Oh, boy. I've just shown myself as not a liver mush eater.
Yeah.
I'm speaking with David Joy, who is speaking about his new book, Where All Light Tends to Go, today on the state of things. You started writing as a small child with your mother's assistance. Tell us about that.
Well, my mother and father had an old electric typewriter that sat under one of the end tables. And I can remember being very young pulling that out. And it was electric, so it had this noise, and it would heat up the paper. And I can remember the way that paper smelled. I can remember the sound of it as the keys went down. But I can't remember the stories. My mom says that I was doing this before I could spell, and that I would tell her stories, and she would dictate the keys to press to spell the stories.
And did you know that you could do this? Did you know that you would grow up and still be writing?
I don't know that I could see it that far back, but the thing that I was able to see was the magic of a word on a page. The fact that, you know, a little blot of ink on a page can make somebody smile or laugh or cry. I recognized that power very early on. I think I recognized it because of the storytelling tradition of people like my grandmother. And you grow up and you realize the power these things have. It's about the closest thing you can get to magic.
This is a fiction book, but you have also written some nonfiction stuff about fly fishing. How different is this fiction realm? Do you like it? Do you like this stuff, or are you ready to get back to?
I was always moving towards the novel. And I think the reason I stayed with nonfiction for so long was because the mentor I had, a brilliant essayist and memoirist named Deidre Elliott, I studied under her for so long. And because of that, I stuck with nonfiction for a really long time. But I always knew that I was moving towards the novel. To be honest, I always wanted to be a short story writer. And I'm not capable of working within those constraints.
It's harder, do you think?
Oh, for me it is. I think the short story is a lot more closely related to poetry. And Faulkner said the same thing. You know, he said he was a failed poet. And he said, you know, that he wanted to write poetry, realized he couldn't, so he tried to write the short story, realized he couldn't, so he wrote the novel. And that's kind of how I wound up where I did, too.
Are you working on another book?
I finished another novel recently. I had a January 1st deadline. That novel's done. We're still working on a title, but working through edits of that. And I've already got something I want to do next. That's where my head is now, is what's next.
In North Carolina, in Western North Carolina, set again?
All set in Jackson County. This second book is set in a place called Little Canada in Jackson County.
Well, you have a good character you know well to keep with you. Thank you very much for speaking with me.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
David Joy is the author of Where All Light Tends to Go. He'll speak tonight at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill, tomorrow at The Regulator in Durham, and Friday at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh. Just ahead, how we approach death and dying.